and welcome to episode 29 of Role Play Grow, the podcast for tabletop entrepreneurs, creators, and fans. I am Courtney Stover of Lighthearted Adventures, and in this podcast, we talk to the creators behind the brands and the tabletop roleplay gaming space about who they are and how they are turning their passion for gaming into a career. T. Julian Bell is the creative director and owner of Dark Veil Studios, which currently has a Kickstarter running for the Dark Veil TTRPG. I'll be honest, y'all, I really want this game, and I think you should absolutely go check out their Kickstarter, which is running until October 15th. I'm not being paid to say this. I just think that the lore and universe building potentials sound really cool, and I'm also pretty fascinated by the mechanics that Julian describes in this interview. He has a pretty amazing story about how this game came to be, and they have some big plans for the Dark Veil universe. Beyond just wanting to promote this Kickstarter because I want the game, I also really enjoyed talking to Julian as he has a wealth of knowledge about project managing a new TTRPG system and goes into pretty elaborate detail on a lot of their processes, including how they decided on their game mechanics and the vital role of playtesting. I really think that y'all will enjoy this episode, but seriously, go to Kickstarter, look up Dark Veil role-playing game, and just check it out. They've still got a little ways left to fund, and like I said, I want this game, so let's see what we can do to help. This is a longer episode than usual, so I will keep the business part short. If this is your first time tuning into the show, hello! This podcast is a part of Lighthearted Adventures, which is a small company I co-founded with my husband. We offer a weekly blog on our website where you'll find tips for running games, free monthly one-shot adventures, product reviews, and more. You'll find that blog at lightheartadventures.com. Britton also creates beautiful dungeon maps both on DM's Guild and on a commission basis. Some other ways you can support us and this show are by subscribing to the show, leaving a review, and checking out our affiliate links. The affiliate that I'm going to highlight today is Found Familiar Coffee, the most delicious and nerdy coffee that you will ever taste, and you'll get to collect some pretty cool D&D-themed art from every package. Go to foundfamiliar.com and enter code LIGHTHEART, A-D-V, to get 10% off your order, enjoy some delicious coffee, and help me keep this show running. That is all for now, so please sit back and enjoy this conversation with Julian. Today, I am with T. Julian Bell, creative director and owner of Dark Veil Studio. Hello, Julian. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you, Courtney?
Doing pretty good. I am very excited to talk about your new game that just kickstarted or launched on Kickstarter a couple days ago. So thank you so much for coming on.
I'm pretty excited to be here. Yep. Dark Veil, the role-playing game, just launched on Kickstarter. You can go check it out right now and go to our website if you want to find out more information as well. But everything's pretty much on the Kickstarter.
Perfect. Well, to kick things off, can you start by telling us a bit about yourself and how you got into gaming?
Yeah, so like most tabletop role players, I've been playing for dozens of years. I got into it about 20 years ago and just loved the hobby, fell in love with it, fell in love with the storytelling. I was big into theater and acting. I have a theater degree from college and anything with improvisation and something where you could really just kind of open up and tell stories. And I love the idea that you could tell a unique story with every game and nothing was ever the same. Every single game had a different experience. And I just really latched onto that. And then I ended up working in the film industry for a long time. And I love storytelling there and that style of work. I love films. However, the culture of filmmaking after many years of working in it kind of just wore me down. And I wanted to do something different. And I said, well, I love role-playing games. And why don't I try to just make a game? And so, I spent many years figuring out how to make a game. And then how to do it professionally and how to project manage it and how to design it and how to do the game design. And then ended up making a game about 8 years ago called Chrome War, the role-playing game. And did that very much almost on my own and learned you can't do this on your own if you want to make something that's a lot more of a career path oriented product. And ended up working in a publishing company for the last 7 years and have done some other small game design and came across a great artist over the years that I locked in with named Chris Belaskis, who is our art director. And we just really locked in together and found that we worked really well together and could make some really creative ideas and ended up coming up with Dark Veil a few years ago. And now we have Dark Veil, the role-playing game.
Okay. So when did this become more of a company?
Yeah, so I wasn't intending on coming back into the creative side of role-playing games. It just, I wasn't intending to do that. And a few years back, I had actually been doing Gen Con and had this moment after a Gen Con of 15 hours a day standing on the hard floors of Gen Con at your booth and just nonstop talking to fans and people coming by and talking about games. And driving to Gen Con, I live in the East Coast and Wilmington, North Carolina, and driving through the mountains of West Virginia and getting there and then driving back, it is an exhausting week. And I did it all by myself, the last Gen Con I had done. And when I got home, I went to the gym. I used to do a lot of martial arts and I was training at the gym and something happened. And I basically just had something wrong neurologically with me. And it, for a long story, I could tell it basically knocked me out for about 5-6 years. And took me away from gaming, took me away from being able to walk and talk properly, took me away from being able to write properly, write a sentence from beginning to end. And so part of the recovery from this, and I've had surgery on my neck and I've gone through a lot of other physical therapy and things to help, but jiu-jitsu, Brazilian jiu-jitsu was helping my brain do this fight or flight thing. So I was doing that. And then I was also doing Sudoku puzzles to help my brain kind of figure out how to connect my handwriting again with my brain. And my writing, my novel writing was terrible. I couldn't connect the beginning of a sentence with the end of a sentence. So I started writing more and I became better at writing. I started doing these Sudoku puzzles, became better at math again. Well, not better at math. I could always do math. My brain just was having a hard time connecting with my hands. And then I started designing a board game. And I called up Chris and hadn't talked to him in a few years. And I said, "Hey, Chris, look, I've been out of the gaming industry for a long time now. I haven't done anything with it, but I have this really interesting idea for a game. And I kind of want to pursue this because it's kind of helping me therapeutically, like get through, recover a bit here." And I had this really cool concept for a board game. It plays cooperatively and all the players are stopping this evil that's coming through these gateways across the planet to fight them back in a very pandemic way where the evil just spreads every turn. And it was this kind of really fun cooperative style of gaming. And we have that board game. We're going to be releasing it next year, hopefully. And we started working on it. And then as we kept going, the story just got better and better. And then we said, okay, well, this feels more like a role-playing game would be really appropriate to maybe launch this story first. And so one thing led to another and our art direction changed. And all of a sudden we were designing Dark Veil, the role-playing game. And so after about a year of working on that, we're at where we are today. And we're really happy with the game design. We're really happy with the storytelling and the art direction. And the big thing for it was, since I was struggling to do things simplistically, the game itself went in the complete opposite direction that I had always done in game design in the past, which is really clunky and crunchy numbers. And I ended up making this very simplistic game that was much more approachable. And I think many listeners would agree and know that the gaming industry right now is becoming much more inclusive than it's ever been. And making a game that, one, graphically helps individuals better read the information on the page and better absorb it. The way you play the game is very simplistic in its design, so that it's very easy to pick up and learn. And then the complexity of strategy is added on after the fact. So now it's more approachable for everyone to play it. And it just became this strategy in the way that we branded and built the product that it was focused more on an inclusive audience. And it just really made this really interesting and I would say really fun, incredible game that we've created.
That is a really cool story. And thank you for sharing that. It's very interesting how it started as wanting to create a board game and then turned into this RPG. So is the board game that you said may release next year going to be a similar storyline?
Yeah, so it's branded in the same universe. So Dark Veil is the IP that we've launched. And when Chris and I got together and decided to do the board game officially, at first it was just, doing a little bit of art for what we were kind of working on. And then it became, hey, we're both a little older. We've both been in different industries before. We both had, our own careers and different things and decided, hey, if we're going to do this, we want to do it right. And we want to build it ourselves and make our own company out of this. We have a culture that we want to follow. We have a way that we want to treat people that we work with. And we just want to make really great, high quality products. And so when we got to the board game and we kept digging into it more, we realized that the story of the board game was, just really that much cooler than we were expecting. And, you know, I have a novel that'll be coming out hopefully next year as well. We're trying to brand these things and line them up to keep providing information to the audience and keep providing quality as we keep launching more things. And so there's going to be these stories in this universe, and the idea of these gates and the way that this evil is coming out of it from this other realm was the precursor to really kind of locking in on what the story for the Dark Veil was. And once we got that story, it just seemed like, hey, let's build a small audience of tabletop role-playing fans that are going to love this and really absorb this and take it on. And they can become our diehard audience as we move forward. And just, you know, they'll continue to get all these different lore benefits as we keep releasing other content that will help them in their tabletop games.
Okay, honestly, yeah, that is really exciting to know that the story does get to keep growing. But let's go ahead and just dive into Dark Veil itself. What can you tell me about the story?
So Dark Veil's setting is based on a universe that's fractured in time. So it's our universe, but it's set a million light years on the other side of our galaxy. So it's on another planet. We do use, you know, it helped that I had the Cromwell role-playing game, you know, 8 or 9 years ago at this point, the lore and the setting of that. So we basically blew that up and took the best parts of it. And we said, this is great. This time period's great. This time period's great. This one's nice, but we're going to change this. And we said, we've got most of the groundwork here done. Let's just refine it and make it better. And so Dark Veil takes place as a moment where the parallel universes of these realms. So if you think of alternate dimensions of darkness and shadow and fear and light and angelic creatures and demonic creatures, they all live in these infinite realms. And there is a realm of time. And so this time realm has broken. And when it broke, it took all of the moments across the universe. So if you think of our moment in time right now as a blanket, the universe is a blanket of one moment in time. And if you cut that blanket up into puzzle pieces, and then you do the same thing for every other moment of time, past and future. And then you shuffle them all up and you rebuild that puzzle. So it is just one blanket worth of all these puzzle pieces, but it's all mixed up now from all these different time periods. That's Dark Veil. So Dark Veil is this rebuilding of the universe for one new time stream. There's no future. There's no past. There's just one new time. And the Dark Veil itself is this purplish cloud of smoke that is around each one of those sectors. So if you think of those puzzle pieces as having like edgy borders, like a puzzle would, that's the Dark Veil. And the Dark Veil is basically a dome that covers each of these sectors of time, each of these areas throughout the universe. And if you were to go from one of these sectors and walk to the neighboring sector, you would have to cross through this Dark Veil wall. But when you crossed over, it would be a different time period, all from the same universe, but just a different moment in time. So it's not time travel. It's literally time has been rewritten. And so the factions of Dark Veil's universe have worked together to build these gateways. And these gateways basically cut through that Dark Veil so that you can walk to the next sector. And so a year has gone since the event of the shattering of this time event. And all of these different factions are now working together to connect the different sectors of time. And all of these factions are working together to, or working against each other to control the different sectors of time. The veil itself, this purplish wall that's protecting or imprisoning all these sectors, is also a gateway to those infinite realms. So if you were to fall into this purplish Dark Veil wall, you would wind up in some unknown realm. So if you fell through it, you might wind up in like the shadow realm, or you could wind up in a frigid, cold, frost, frozen place of unknown creatures and mystery. And you can navigate that travel through these different realms through the veil if you know where you're going. So certain magi are starting to understand how to navigate it. But also those creatures within those realms are starting to understand how to navigate out and reach into our universe. So that's really the conflict of the game setting, is that all of these different time periods, your character might be from one of them, but is now working with organizations from different time periods or across these different time periods, using documentation to travel through these gates, dealing with conflicts of creatures and monsters that are coming from the realms. The players are using magic. They're using tactics. They can steal magic and tactics from other creatures and other players and other things happening around them. And they basically interact in this survival-based new world that they have to kind of learn and discover together.
What was the inspiration for this story?
So the universe itself is a refugee world. And it was that, how do we create a new world that's not like other games, not like other worlds, but it was something that felt unique, but at the same time, nostalgic, right? The one thing that I think we all love about storytelling is that it's 80% based in reality and 20% not. It's that 20% that's not. That's the exciting part that makes it different. I mean, I think there's only, is it 9 or 11 different types of storytelling that has evolved with like Aristotelian structure coming back. I'm going to go back to date myself in college in the early 2000s, learning about storytelling and understanding like the, you know, there's murder, there's love, there's betrayal, there's war, there's survival. There's only so many different stories you can tell. And I think when you get to like tabletop role-playing games and you get to, you know, new universes, there's a lot of repeated subject matter. And so tried to kind of steer clear of all of the tropey ideas of universe building and really just focus on the things that felt cool and different, and then create a universe that was organically built out of the history of that universe. So when I made Cromwar years ago, it was this 10,000 years of history, and started at the beginning and said, well, if this moment happens, what would happen next? And then built the entire universe history that way. And then that kind of gave us everything we need to use for Dark Veil, because we said, okay, well, here's where the fans really liked this part of the time period, and they really liked this moment in time and this moment in time. And so we took all those best bits and then dropped them into the Dark Veil setting. And now you have these best bits of, okay, how would they interact with each other? Okay, cool. Well, this organization would show up, and then this one would show up. And so that's really what inspired it was, oh, we really like the idea of steampunk, but we don't want the goofiness of the steampunk. We want more of a dieselpunk feel in a World War One kind of emotional state. Great. Well, we'll put giant steam golem creatures that are on the edge of the great metal war front for this one sector. And they were put there by another faction that's now 300 years in the future. So they've made peace and they've moved on, but this group's still at war with the robots that were left behind. So you get these setups that become these really interesting hooks for players and for storytelling, and they just work really well.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to be really fun and unique to have all of these different scenarios with people from different, like your characters would have such a different perspective on life based off of which section they came from.
Yes, absolutely. And when you create a character in this game, we don't have classes, and we try to do something a little bit different, which, I mean, there's so many role-playing games out there. So there's going to be a similarity to one game with just about every choice that was made. It's about the choices that we made together that make up the whole. And when you create a character, you're creating a background origin. So you're choosing what time period is this character from? What ancestry are they from? So which, you know, alien or species group have they come out of in their character's past? Was it working with humans from Earth that were brought to this planet as refugees thousands of years ago and then evolved on this planet with some of the customs of Earth? Or was it that you're an alien that was dropped off on this planet and had to survive and kind of build your own cultural identity? Or were you a alien ancestry that started on this planet and then you've had to evolve with all of these other kind of groups coming here? And so you start with that. So your character already has some sort of cultural identity, and then they choose their background, which is poor, rich, wealthy. You're brought up in the military. You make these choices as a player, and it defines for those players that sometimes struggle to figure out what their background is for the character, and also helps those players that already really know what they want to do to say, oh, this fits perfectly for me. And you start going down that. We also include sort of these introspective ideas of, is my character an optimist, or is my character a pessimist? Is my character interested in glory, or is my character just wanderlust traveling the universe looking for adventure? And so we set those things up for the player ahead of time. And then as they go through, they choose an organization to start with. And we have 20 organizations that will be launching with the book. And those 20 organizations are what drive the player's initial thoughts and interests as, you know, what do I do with this character? And those organizations will give the character special traits. Those special traits will then kind of define the character's starting point. But they are by no means set the character up to be destined to stay in that organization forever. And that's how you start the character. You also have these skills. So skills are the mechanic behind the game. There's no attributes. There are no additional modifiers to your character other than what you get in your background, what your organization gives you in traits, and then the skills themselves. And the mechanics are D6 dice system that rolls for successes. And we can talk about mechanics if you like, but that really helps the character construction for the player, that the player feels when they start off, they already kind of know where they fit within the universe. And as we're writing these organizations, we're writing them as kind of lore background. So when you're reading what organization you're joining, it's not, well, you're a fighter, you fight something, your job is to go out and trip something, or your job is to go out and stab something, and that's your role in the party. Instead, it's you're part of this organization, and this is your role within the universe, and this is how your character fits into the bigger whole. Now, we're going to send you off to the rest of the universe and go survive within it with what you know.
Yeah, that sounds really fun and like such interesting characters that we could make. But yeah, you mentioned the mechanics. And so I do want to talk a bit about the mechanics, but I also want to know, after we go over that, how you decided what your system was going to be, because there's a lot of options that are out there that already exist and can be adapted. Or, you know, starting from scratch. I'd just love to know a bit about that decision process too.
Yeah, that's probably the million-dollar question for a game designer. And I'll say, you know, I'm not perfect by any means. For anyone, you know, all intents and purposes, I'm a new game designer in the world of the TTRPG space. I've done it a few times now, and I've spent 5 years creating Chrome War from D12s and D100s and D20s and trying to find the perfect mechanic to fit that the game style. I ended up with a D4 system, which there are plenty of Caltrop jokes about dropping D4s and stepping on them while you're playing. But that game's so crunchy and was, how do we fit everything into this toolbox of a book to give the player everything they want to do? And so, like I said, I was kind of trying to make this game much more inclusive to an audience that may not be as skilled to do that kind of math, or that may not be interested in doing that much work to figure out those numbers as they go. And it wanted to be more storytelling of a game mechanic. So when I set out to build the game mechanic for this game, I really look at what does the game need first. And so I set three parameters for myself in the scope, if you will. I'm a project manager by trade. So I really just focus on, like, here's my scope and here's the things that I'm going to define it by, and now I'm going to stick to it. And so I set these three tenets out. I said, one, I want everyone to have fun. You said it sounds fun. It is fun. And I don't just say that from being biased. People really enjoy the system. It's a fun system. And it wasn't always fun. We had to test to get to what is the fun factor. And I'll talk about that. But it had to be fun. It just that every role had to feel like it was exciting for the player. And in that, the second rule was every role had to be able to provide the player the ability to do something incredible or something incredibly terrible. Basically, you have to be able to critically do well and critically fail with every die roll. And that's something that a lot of games just don't offer. And so I didn't want to use another system and try to plug it into Dark Veil. I wanted to give Dark Veil what it needed to be, the game that it needed to be. And I think this is where most game designers kind of make mistakes in early days, is you see a game come out and it might be a really interesting setting, and then they take and they go, well, I use this system that's already people know because it's going to be easier for people to buy the game because it's attached to this system and they already know it. And that's fine, but I feel like myself personally, it's a bit of a, it's not really doing the justice that you should do for the mechanic of how that game should be played. Choose how you'd like the game to be played and build the mechanics around that. Don't just try to shove a square peg into a round hole and hope it works, because it's just not going to feel as unique. It's going to feel like you have a game mechanic and you have a setting, and they're two completely different things. But if you build them together and you build a mechanic that supports your setting and the setting supports your game design of dice rolling or whatever it is that you choose, Jenga Tower, that is going to make much more interesting and unique game for your audience. And it's also going to make you stand out, and your game isn't going to get lost into the, oh, well, that's this setting matches that game, so now it's just part of that universe. It's going to make you help stand on your own as a designer. And it's probably going to make you better as a designer, because you're going to have to think more as well. So anyway, so there's three things, right? So fun, players have to feel like every role that they make has the option of doing something epic or something terribly epic. So great epic, bad epic. So it has to be every role. And then Oh man, I'm going to forget my third thing here. Oh, people like to roll dice. That was the third part, is every time we play test, it didn't matter. People just like to roll dice. You want them to roll dice. But yeah, the way that I came to the conclusion of this dice mechanic was with those three things: fun, rolling dice, and every roll had to be unique. And so I struggled for a while to find out what it was mathematically with a bell curve, putting it on paper, and then just doing a lot of Excel documentation and a lot of math, and finding out what is the probability I want to have occur. And when I do game design, I always break it down to the bare minimum numbers, plus one, minus one kind of concept. So bare bones, what do I need to do as a player? Like, what do I want this character to do as a player in this moment? Well, I want my character to be able to cast this spell. Great. How am I going to have that character cast that spell? Well, I don't know. They cast a spell. We'll figure out how that happens. What does that spell then do to the target? Well, the spell is going to do this thing. So you start getting into this, what's the defense look like? What is the thing that I want to do look like? What are the skills I want available to do them? Am I going to use skills themselves? Am I going to use concepts? Is it going to be like I flip a card and that determines my fate, or does the player determine their fate? So you start breaking down what's the best options. And Dark Veil became a game about traveling between these different times and sectors, which meant there's a big problem in some games in terms of balance of weapons and gear. And so does my futuristic weapon match up with this medieval sword? So that became something really quickly that had to be determined before I could add anything else onto the game. And so it became a, how do I balance this? And I was dealing with all these, well, if I roll these numbers and add them up, and well, what if I put some sort of block on certain types of weapons, or certain characters have benefits with using higher weapons? And you start getting into all these complicated things. And that was the direction where I probably did that for like a month. And I decided this is too complicated. I need to strip all of this away to its bare bones. Role-playing is about making a story and telling that story. And the dice really just help determine the fate of the story. And so I had to tear down all those complex things and eventually came to the idea of success-based rolling. And I know other games do this. I will be honest, I'm not familiar with a lot of other games. So I can only base on someone saying, that sounds like this game, but this mechanic's not in there, so it's slightly different. So I came to the conclusion of success-based rolling, which I found D6s had the best math for that. You've got 1 to 6, you roll the D6 and decided that a 5 and a 6 would be successes. And then eventually decided that a 6, if it landed on it, it would explode and you'd get to reroll again. So that fits that tenet of the player gets excited about rolling. And with those rolls, every roll could potentially land on a 6 and they could keep rolling it. This goes back to, I think, Shadowrun, which uses tons of D6 dice. If you roll a, you know, I played that ages ago and I remembered the excitement you got when rolling a 6. So I said, okay, well, that's a great concept to glean from that. And so 5s and 6s are successes. 6s explode, you reroll them. So we play tested this for several months and it went really well. Players really started to like it. And so the balance became not about +1, +2, +3. It became about how many successes do I need to complete this task? And 1/6 chance of getting that reroll, you've got a 2/3 chance of getting a success in general on your roll. And then it became a, well, how do I balance this out? Well, I'll just give more dice to the player. So how many dice is too many dice? What's the perfect number? There's a lot of bell curves and math here. We found that 4 dice is when it starts to become a lot easier for the player to complete certain things. So your skills range from everyone gets 1 die in everything. And then up to 4 die is kind of like that starter zone. So you create your character and you can only have up to 4 dice in any skill. And we have 20, I want to say it's 21 skills, maybe 24. It's one of those two. I keep getting it mixed up when I'm on interviews and I always try to double check myself after. We've got these different skills. You can have certain skill dice in it. And then kind of maxed out around 8 dice felt like it was at the high end of the bell curve. There was really kind of diminishing returns after a certain point. And so those 5, 6, 7, and 8, having that many dice in a skill became the higher level. So you can unlock those additional dice by spending story points, our form of experience. And so that became the mechanic of, here's how the game is played. You roll these dice to gain the successes. It was great, except it was missing something. It was missing that critical failure element. So you've got this chance to always succeed with those die rolls and always feel like something epic could happen, but there was no failure element. And so we included this burn mechanic. So anytime you roll a 1 on the die, it now burns that die. And so what that means is you have three actions on your turn in the game. So that allows you to take these skills that you have and decide on your turn, I'm going to do a different skill for every action, or I'm going to do the same skill for every action, or I'm going to break this up and do two skills, and one of them is going to be one action and the other skill is going to have two. So I like the example of you're running away from the city guard, they're chasing you through the streets, and you quickly duck into an alley. So your first skill, you make a stealth skill. You need a certain number of successes over that crowd that's chasing you is going to attempt to try to perceive you with the same number of actions. It's called a face-off dice roll we have. And so you roll your dice. Let's say you have three successes on that first action because you just decided you're going to do stealth for the first action. That's perfect. So you stealth into the corner. The city that's chasing after you only got two successes, not enough to see you. So you disappear in the alley. The next two actions you're going to use to climb the side of a building. So you have fitness you're going to use for the next two actions. So you declare this at the top of your turn. You roll those three successes. But on those three successes, one of those die was a six and re-rolled as a one. So now that die got burned in your first action. What it means is all the consecutive turns, that die is no longer available. So even though you have different dice for your stealth and different dice for your fitness is now suffering by losing that die when you roll for your fitness skill. So let's say you normally have three dice for your fitness skill as well. Now you're down to two dice on your second action. So you roll that and you get two fives. Great, you got two successes, but you still have to roll your third action. So you roll your third action and you end up getting two ones. And so now you've burned all your dice. You have no dice left. That means it's a critical failure. So your character ducks into the alley and hides, but then climbs the side of the building to try to get a better vantage point. And you critically fail and fall through the roof. And you land on a table of off-duty guards, and you are now caught by the guards. So it allows for the game mechanic to benefit, like that player gets this high when they're rolling. It's almost like we call it the gambler's mechanic on our internally. And we don't have a term for what this mechanic is called. There's no official, like, this is the Dark Veil, whatever mechanic. It's just the Dark Veil gambler's mechanic. And so the player gets excited when they roll these sixes because they get to re-roll it. But at the same time, they're taking a risk every time they do it because they could critically fail and burn those dice. And it becomes this really epic, exciting moment with, oh, I got what I wanted to do, but I still have another action that I have to roll through. And I don't know if I'm going to critically fail. And that tension is where the game all of a sudden becomes fun. And that risk reward factor just nailed it for us. And once we figured that out, it just changed the way that everyone perceived it from the playtesting side. And it just became this whole new game of really, really locking into what we were trying to do with the game. And we're really happy with that.
Yeah, that sounds like such an intense scenario. And I love it. That sounds so fun. I'm getting really excited just listening about that. Hey, entrepreneurs! I love introducing you to new creators every episode, but I could really use your support. I would love to invite you to join our Patreon page, where you'll gain access to behind-the-scenes content, add your questions to upcoming interviews, and you could even receive a shout-out on our site in an upcoming episode. To learn more, go to lightheartadventures.com/RPG. And now, back to the show. How long would you say that it took for y'all to go through that whole process of having the different ideas, doing the playtesting, refining it until you got to that final form of the mechanics?
So one of the things about good planning, I think, is not going over and doing things that are going to be edited out later. And so the first time I made a role-playing game, I didn't know what I was doing. I was looking at, oh, is this D12 system work? Is this D6 system work? Does this D4 system work? I was trying everything that already existed. Really, I was pulling out those other games and saying, what does this game do really well? Do I want to steal that? Or do I want to use that mechanic and do some sort of open licensing or whatever? And this time around, I haven't been in the game for a long time. I haven't been in the game design game for a while. I've been out of touch with, I hadn't played a game in years. I've been out of touch with my own self and, you know, what I could possibly even do. And so I really just planned it. I said, I don't have a lot of time. I still have a job as a director of project management for a publishing company. I needed to be able to do something within time constraint that allowed me to be creative and also not waste anything, not waste effort. And I knew that I would be playtesting on nights and weekends. So I would have to set up a couple games a week with playtesters, amazing group of playtesters that we've had for years. Pulled a lot of the old playtesters had in the past, came back out of the woodwork, and were like, yeah, we'll test another game with you. We'll break this for you again. And took about, I want to say 8 months before we came down to the burning the one, that die. And so there was about 8 months of just back and forth testing. We're also testing the board game at the same time. And that board game is a very simplistic system as well. It's a little different than what we have for the Darkfield role-playing game, but it is, in essence, the same concept of simplicity. How do we make this a simple but fun game? And between those two, once we got to the point where it just clicked, and I can't remember the exact day or moment, but I do remember the feeling of, I wasn't at my desk. I was walking around probably in my house in the midst of COVID. And just it came to me of this concept of why don't I use the one to burn it? And we've got these three actions. Why doesn't it burn consecutive dice? And once that hit, immediately once we started playtesting it, it showed the difference. And as a game designer, what you should do is you should send out surveys immediately after you playtest with individuals. You should playtest with different individuals. So not always the same people, because they're going to be biased. They've seen the transitions over time. Go ahead and get yourself a base of like 50 people, if possible, to play test with. You don't have to get them all at once, but start with a small group of about 10. Play in small group. You don't need 5-6 people in a game. You just need like 2 or 3 max. And that'll allow them a lot more time to think about things and a lot more engagement. Play test with them for probably a month, and then switch to another group. And then switch to another group. And once you get about 6 months in and you've changed a lot of these mechanics, every time you've got a new group, try something a little, like for 3 groups or so, keep it the same, and then try something different. And then bring back that group that was 6 months ago or a year ago. There's one particular group that I had brought in at the beginning, and then I brought in about a year later. And when they played it, at the end of that game, several of them said, I played this before and it was fun. I played it now and it felt like it was sophisticated and you had gone through the work. And they said you could tell that there was work done. It just felt cleaner. It felt smoother. And that's what you want to hear from a player. A really good play tester is that they're thinking about those things and the differences, but you also still want them to criticize things and just be open to the information. Everyone's going to have a different opinion. Not all of them you have to like, but listening to the feedback allowed us to really kind of write down those notes. And it, you know, everything we would do, we would send a survey out afterward. And so you constantly have this updated information of this pool of all these people seem to like this. There were a couple people that were hesitant about these things. What is it about that they're hesitant that we can go back and look at to make that better? And if you follow that pattern and you just stay really thick-skinned about some of the negative feedback you're going to get, it's going to happen. Don't worry about it. Focus on the things that, why was this an issue for someone? What could I do differently? Just in a small way that may be able to correct that. And you're going to wind up with something that works for your system. And that's what we did. And, you know, it was up until the end that we had always had stealing of magic as a thing. And we never had tactics as a stealing thing. So you can steal magic in the game. So if you see someone cast a spell or there's a spell written on a wall, your character can attempt to learn it with Spell Thief. And then if you learn it and you get enough successes, you'll permanently learn it and it becomes part of your character. And it's a really, really fun thing for players to do. Just ran a game at Gen Con last night on main stage. It's on YouTube. You can watch it right now. Gen Con Darkvale main stage. And that game, at the very beginning, there was like a paparazzi group of mixed reporters and scribes that were covering an event that was taking place. And one of the reporters used a spell to basically capture the group in this image and then recreate it on a piece of canvas. And it was just a fun little spell that I threw out there. And I threw to the players. I said, if anyone would like to steal this, you can roll to steal it. And the reaction from the players of, we can do that, was just this wonderful feeling as a game designer that you see them react that way and go, that's exactly how I want them to react. I want them to all go, wow, I can do that. That's so cool. And they all rolled. Only one of them got it. But now that one character learned that spell. And they could basically take a scene or take a moment, take a snapshot, cast magic, capture that moment and then put it on some sort of paper or a wall. And it just creates this fun factor. And those are the things that we had with magic, but we didn't have it with anything else. And we got this one piece of feedback from a great playtester that playtested with us where they said, well, magic feels great, but now combat just feels kind of weak in comparison. And so what's the value of me being somebody that swings a sword? And so we just looked at that one piece of feedback and it was one player. And I went, yeah, duh, we screwed up. We should have tactics be able to be stolen too. If somebody does some sort of cool fight sequence, you should be able to do that same thing. And so once we added that, it balanced it out. And Yeah. From game design perspective, when you're testing like that, you just listen to the audience that, you know, even if you don't agree with it, because you're maybe you have your ego is a little strong at that moment, you're really proud of what you've created and somebody's knocking it down. Just listen to it, to be a really good listener and go, okay, well, I may not agree with them, but why do they feel that way? What is it that that's making them feel that way? And once you touch on that, you can just correct it.
That's really good advice. And those are some really great examples of just the journey that it's taken and how amazing your playtesters sound.
They're it. I mean, I would not be able to do this game. It would not be the game that it is if the playtesters weren't there, if there wasn't an audience for it. I mean, at the end of the day, we're making this game for people to enjoy and have fun. I'm not making it because I just want to prove that I can do it, right? I've done that before and I'm happy with the game that we made before, but this is something different. This is a game that's, it's almost like we're challenging ourselves to make the best possible game that we can make. And we don't really care about having to appease a system that already exists. We don't care about having to appease a setting that already exists. We just care about making the best quality setting and game that we have. And the end goal of this is to create a brand and an IP that we'll have novels for, we'll have potentially, you know, TV shows or comic books. You know, we want to do all those things with this IP. We think that it's a really exciting idea to have a episodic TV show that took place in a sector that was building a gate to go to these different time periods. And the creatures that could come out of the veil and the conflict of the different factions fighting, you could spend an entire season in one sector. And then the next season could break into a second sector or into the veil itself. There's so much great storytelling here that we just couldn't let it go. And we realized we were just onto something really cool.
Yeah, I love that so much. I do want to make sure that we've got some time to dig into a little bit more of your processes, because as a fellow project manager, I love to dig into the nitty gritty of, you know, just kind of start to finish and figuring out what your whole development process was. So I'd like to start with going back to what you said earlier about when you realized that this had the potential to be something much bigger and turn into a tabletop RPG. What has the development process been like to get you from there to here?
Yeah, I think, you know, as a PM, I think the big thing that we always think about is just avoiding risk, right? I mean, that's like 101 project management is how do I avoid risk in this situation? What's the time? What's the cost? You know, what's the quality level we're looking for? And you just kind of have to look at those things and really be honest with yourself as the project manager and as the creative director, right? They're two different things. A creative director with project management skills is great. A creative director with a bias of, I really want to make this thing this way, is dangerous when you're a PM. I'm a really terrible project manager with my own creative ideas, right? I want to edit my own stuff. I want to go back and add things when I'm past a deadline. So you have to set some limits on yourself. You have to really focus in on your goals, and time is the key for you as a creator, right? We've all got games that we want to create. If we're listening, or I'm sure if your audience is listening to this, they're probably game designers, or they're probably individuals that want to create games. And everybody's going, oh, how do I do it? I have this great idea, but I don't know how to do it. The key is focusing on what you're good at. And so I'm good at the game design. I'm good at listening. I'm really good at listening to the audience and the players and figuring out what they need in that moment. It's one thing that project managers do when we facilitate. Your goal in a facilitation as a PM, or at least I believe the goal of a project manager should be, that they're listening to the stakeholders in the room. They're listening to the players in terms of a game, and they're figuring out what they need. What does that player need to make them happy? And what do they need to make them grow as a character, you know, for this adventure? What can I give them to give them that best adventure? In a project, you do the same thing. Oh, this engineer needs this, this builder needs this, the marketing team needs this. And you make sure that they have everything that you need and you take care of them and make sure that you negotiate with them when there's something that they're asking too much of and kind of pull them back. You have to do that to yourself as a game designer as well. You can't go too far. Oh, I really love this idea. I'm just going to run down that road. You need to plan it out ahead of time, take a lot of notes, constantly follow through your notes and make sure you have a to-do list and make sure you stay on your to-do list. Here's the number one tip for, this is project management 101 made easy. Write a list of everything you need to do. Every single thing. From beginning to end, I need to write this section of the book. I need to write this section of the book. I need to come up with this game concept. I need to figure out how this lore fits into the world. I need to make a book. I need to find people to playtest. All the things you need to do, make one giant list, and then organize that list into a bunch of groups in terms of, these are all the things I need to do for the content portion. These are all the things I need to do for the design portion. These are all the things I need to do for marketing portion. And then you create these little groups of things. And then you say, am I good at this? And the answer is probably some of them yes, and a lot of them no. And you have to be really honest with yourself. I can't draw a stick figure to save my life. Chris is our artist and he's our art director. He's fantastic at it. But I do graphic design work. My graphic design's okay. It's not terrible. I think there's amazing graphic designers out there better than me. But as we are right now at the company size that we're at, I have to do a lot of the graphic work. So I have to figure out the time that I can spend doing graphic design work and the time I can spend writing and doing game design. You need to find people to work with to do the other things that you're not good at. And that's going to help you out tremendously from the time aspect of this. You then have to figure out what your costs are. Do you have money? Do you not have money? Are you self investing to make this happen? Do you have an investor? Is there somebody else that's going to help you do this? Key factor to that is, do you want to do this as a hobby? Do you want to do this as a small company? Do you want to do this as a big company? Determine those things right out the gate and be honest with yourself and say, I'm just going to make something small for my friends and I'm going to really enjoy that and it only needs to be that big. Or I'm going to make something and I'm putting it on Kickstarter and I'm going to do it one off. And once it's done, it'll be great. It'll be out there. Or I'm going to make something that's going to run for 10, 15 years. Decide those factors. So you create a list, you figure out which all the groups that those list items go into. And then you start tackling that list in order of what needs to get done first. Stay to the list, stay to that to-do list, and you will get it done. And that's it. It's the easiest thing in the world once you figure out that you can just make a list and then do them, check them off. It's really, really hard to stay on it. And I think that the biggest question I get a lot from my project managers that I manage at a director level, because I don't do all the day-to-day project work anymore. I have these fantastic project managers that I work with that do, is really just helping them talk through the schedule of things that they have to do. What's first, what's second, and what's last. And so once you kind of lay that out for them, you often see a project manager kind of like, oh, okay, I feel so much better now that I've just looked at the information and laid it out in order of what I have to do. And it just gives them a to-do list. And we all work better when we have a list of something to do as opposed to trying to just figure it out and grab things in the air. And when you can lay that out from beginning to end of this is most important, then this next step, you're going to find that you move so much quicker and you're doing a lot less editing later of changing things. Now, this does also mean that you have to have the skill in whatever pieces are that you're doing. So it will take time to kind of understand, like, am I good at this? You're going to have to figure that out.
Yeah. Sequencing events is always the fun challenge. Mm-hmm. Gosh. Yeah, okay. You've mentioned a couple of times that you've been able to grow the team a little bit. It sounds like it's still pretty small, but so how large is the team and how did you go about recruiting people?
There's a couple aspects to that. And I don't want anybody to think that we just have this massive team of employees. We don't. We have a lot of contractors. So these are individuals that work with us on project-based work. So our writers are mostly doing like 5,000 words at a time or less. And basically you find a writer that you really like the way they write. They fit your style of what you're trying to do. They're fantastic writers. Same thing with artists out there. There's a ton of great writers and artists. Some of them just don't fit what we're trying to do. They don't match up to what we're doing today. And it might take too long to try to get them to match up to that. They might be fantastic. They might be awesome people. They're just never going to get up to what you're looking for. So pick and choose wisely of the individuals you do choose. Once you find individuals that you like, I would recommend if you're starting new or you're starting small, do not hire out a ton of people like we've done. We have 7 writers working on all different parts of the lore. The universe is massive. Obviously, we've got a really big universe to fill with. We've got all these different time periods, all these different organizations and different factions. We needed a lot of different perspectives. And I wanted to hire individuals that were not like me. I'm a white, straight male who's just about 40. I wanted perspectives of individuals that were not that. And so, you know, trying to find writers that had other life experiences, it was going to give the work more different options and direction in the style that it's written in. And so that was a really key factor of our company. We wanted to be more inclusive to allow different voices to tell their stories within this universe. And so we hired a whole group of other writers of all sorts of different variety of walks of life and different skill sets. And they're all adding these great elements to the world. So they're paid as contractors. So that means they may only work on one section. They may work on more depending on their availability. And that's it. So that we've got quite a few of them. So we have to manage them. So I have to work with them on a regular basis. Again, remember the time factor here. Don't grab a whole bunch of people you have to work with, and then you end up spending all of your time administrating the company. And which is one of the problems I have a lot is I've spread so much of the work to a lot of different individuals that I have very little time to do the work that I need to do. But I've done most of the work ahead of time. We've got the quick play and the adventure preview out there. So we've got the structure already built for all of our writers so they kind of know what format to stay in. So once you find writers, if you want to find other writers, you could write it yourself if you're a great writer, or if you're just an amateur writer and you have a great editor or something, you could always do that. Artists is the same concept. We have Chris on team, and then we have Shen Fi, who's done a ton of work for us, but is a contractor. And so Shen is not a DVS employee, and you know that's the same thing. Chris is. So Chris does a lot of the majority of the work, and Chris's art direction is what's driven us. We have a marketing team member that's on the team. We have a production manager that's on the team. And then everyone else is basically contracted in, or they're part-time, or they're working for us independently. We have some game designer. We have a game ambassador that helps us coordinate and organize and run actual plays. I know nothing about the community of the game industry right now. So that person helps me connect with the rest of the world and connect our product and brand and our voice with the rest of the community. So it's not that we have a huge company. I think there's 19 people on our Kickstarter page. Those are all the individuals that have helped us make Dark Veil to where it is. You know, trailers, Emily Sweet, actress, wonderful person and wonderful voice for our trailer. If anyone's seen the trailer, Emily Sweet did the VO work on that. She's fantastic. You should use her in other VO work. Little plug for Emily. But we found Emily through Chris, our art director. I knew Emily. Emily was out working. I think we just sent her the trailer. She was on set in full costume on set when she saw the trailer. And so she was a part of that trailer, but also the team at Hexy, Tomas Barr, and there's so many great people over there. There's several people at Hexy Studios that worked on the trailer over the last couple months. And then the 3D miniatures was also Hexy Studio, other individuals from that team, Merrick over there, Peter, many other modelers that did the 3D modeling. There's just so many people that it takes to do these finer things that we just don't have a skill set for. We weren't going to learn how to do 3D models. We were going to hire somebody that could. And we don't know how to do all the great animation that Tomas and his team can do with the trailer. So we hired Tomas to do it. You know, you got to pick and choose your battles. Our company is very small. I mean, at the end of the day, it's Chris and I. And now it's a lot of other people adding content to that. We would like to make enough to get enough of an audience, to get enough pre-orders, to get enough people buying the game as it comes out, that we can hire these team members full-time and give them, you know, living wages and beyond. The goal, our culture for our business would be to grow it so that we can fund these employees' lives from a business side, you know, give them medical insurance, give them the ability to buy homes, give them the ability to feel like they could work in this industry. And that's the career for them. We want to get there. We just aren't there. You know, we don't have any investors. We're, you know, completely independently funded from ourselves. And for right now, we're really just working towards getting known and showing that we're a company that could be a really cool game company and that people should support, because we just want to give back to the gaming community.
Yeah. And I definitely think that y'all will be able to get there with just all of the plans that you've got for this board game, for these novels, which I appreciate how long-term this is and that it's going off to a great start with this Kickstarter, but that's just the start. I'm excited to see what y'all do in the future.
And we know that, you know, role-playing games are not where there's the money at either. You know, role-playing games are where there's the fans at. And that's really why we started there. We need to build a fan base before we can move on beyond that. We know we have to get a trusting fan base first. We can't just throw a really cool, awesome product out there and there's nobody that trusts us. Nobody knows who we are. No one knows if they can, especially in the industry right now. I think there's a lot of tension. There's a lot of individuals that are maybe making mistakes in certain places that they're getting called out for on it. And the trust factor is hot right now. And it's a big topic with a lot of game companies, and not just, you know, tabletop role-playing games, but video game companies, entertainment industry I've worked in for over a decade. There's just a lot of mistrust, and we want to prove to everyone that, hey, look, we're in this for the fun. We're in this to make really high quality, great stuff. And we want to be super inclusive. And that means including everyone. And that's part of our shtick, is that we're real, we'll be open, we're willing to talk about just about anything. And we just want to make really cool games. And once we get that out there, and once people see the games that we have and play them, we think we've got something really great that they'll connect to, and we'll just keep delivering really cool stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's definitely been a rough couple of months as things have come to light. Yeah. So I totally hear you on that.
It's a small community. I mean, even doing the game that I did 8 years ago, I still have some great contacts and friends that I've made over the years. And it's amazing how small of a community it is. And I will say this, it's really disheartening to see, like, I hate social media. I'm not on Facebook. I got off Facebook when an election occurred in the United States a few years ago. And, you know, with COVID, tensions are high. People are stuck in their houses. You know, my partner and I just work next to each other all day long in our office, and we can't really go on vacation yet. You know, we can't do these things that we want to do. We can't see family. Everyone's got this tension right now built up, and it's not helped anything when you see, I always get upset when I see anyone just being negative on social media, and it pulls everyone into this mob mentality. And right or wrong, I just hate seeing the negativeness. And, you know, I'm in this industry because I want people to share stories and have these really great experiences. And when I see that, it's really disheartening. So my message to all of you is, before you click send on something, take some time and just think about what the purpose is of why you're sending it. Are you sending it just because you're angry, or are you sending it because there's a reason? And just let's all try to talk a little bit more. I think that would be helpful too.
Yeah. I'm only on Twitter these days because of trying to be in this industry and connect with people, but it's rough. Cool. Well, I know that we are getting a little bit closer to the end of our time, but I do want to make sure that I have a chance to ask you a question that I like to ask in all of my interviews. Which, the reason that I like to ask this question is that we love to focus on, you know, the cool projects and how awesome it is to work within this industry that we love. But I do like to acknowledge that there are challenges that come with working in these games. So I want to ask you that, when you look back over the last couple of years, as you've been kind of coming back into this industry, creating Dark Veil, getting Dark Veil Studios up and off the ground, what would you say has been the most challenging part?
I mean, kind of what we were just saying there. You know, I think the challenging part is that I think because the industry is so small, because it is an industry that is built around, and we're talking just tabletop role-playing games here, not board game industry and you know, novel industry and whatever else. It's art. You know, art is a passion thing. And I think when people play role-playing games, often, you know, myself included, we take on these games and we make them ours, and we often feel like they belong to us because we spend so many hours playing them. And I think that there is a challenge as a game designer, especially as a, you know, coming back into the world, brand new game designer, I don't have the credentials behind myself. You know, I have to rely on others on our team and, you know, these great fans that are just promoting Dark Veil already out there in such great ways. The challenge is having the thick skin to understand that everyone's going to talk to you a little differently. So since it is a smaller community, it's very easy for someone to just contact me. It's very easy for someone to make a post and direct it at me, or come to our Discord, or jump in a game with me. And I think what a lot of times people forget is that there are, you know, 19 other people that are helping us make this thing real. There are, you know, hundreds of other people that are not posting on something that are also following it or playing it. And a lot of people sometimes take this on, you know, take games on to be their own, and they want everything one way. And kind of where I'm leaning to is there's a politeness factor that I'm going to call it out right now. And there are a lot of people that are very rude when they talk to you. And as a company, it's very disheartening in the community to have that. And that is the hardest thing that I've seen in this TTRPG space, is that there are just, you know, it's the tone, it's the way you talk to someone. You know, your website is doing this and it's bad and I hate this. Those kind of things are very negative. And what they may not realize is the graphic designer that put that together or the editor that did that spent a lot of hours to do it. Or maybe they were, you know, they were doing it out of the kindness of their heart, possibly. And when people act that way, it's very negative. It's very hard to want to work in this industry when you see that kind of negativity. It's the same thing with social media. I'm on social media to promote our business. I would have a hard time going to it on my own if I did not have this business, simply because I don't like that kind of negativity. And I'm a very like, want to look at the positive glass half full person, but it's very hard. It's a challenging thing. You got to have thick skin to be able to do this and to be able to respond back to people in a positive way as well. Like, hey, look, I hear you. We're going to work on that. Thanks so much for the feedback. It gets incredibly challenging after the, you know, the 50th person's just been rude. And I feel bad for the others in the world of any product that they're making, you know, even the film industry, it's the same way. Somebody works really hard on a film and there's hundreds of people that work for it. And then someone goes online and just trashes the film negatively. It's just it's a really disheartening thing in any artistic craft when you see people that purposely go out of their way to kind of tear something down. And I would just, you know, just kind of like a disclaimer to all of you, think about what you're doing before you do it. There are so many great artists and creators out there making things and purposely just going after them for no reason other than to just do it is always the thing that is, I feel like a really, it's not needed in this community. And it is a small community. So I think we all can make a change and do better.
Yeah. It's like having that protection of the screen and being able to be anonymous can definitely make people into total jerks.
Yeah. And it's not that, you know, we've had like nothing terrible, but this is more of just the perception of the industry. And, you know, there are some things that have been said that, you know, you go, wow, does this person realize that there's a human on the other side of this? And like, do they realize we're making this game for them? And it's really, and keep in mind, that's the 1%. There are 99% other individuals that are just great and really wonderful. And it's just that it's, that would be my advice and my thoughts about that's the most challenging part of this industry. There are plenty of other industries you could work in. There's also negativity out there, but I feel like because we make such a personal passion to make these things our own, we take a lot of that ownership on in a lot of ways. And sometimes that passion can be a little bit, needs to be just checked. Check what you're saying before you say it.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, let's flip it around and get on a more positive note. So
absolutely.
Same start of the question of when you look back over the time that you've spent getting back into this and making this game happen, what would you say has been the most rewarding part?
Yeah, the rewarding part's the opposite side of that, right? So I can remember back to the first convention I did. It was a very small convention out here in North Carolina, and it was at this arcade with flashing lights and sounds and things going off. And it was a sci-fi convention, which is wild at an arcade. And the booth that I had was set up with these bright flashing lights and loud noises going off on this arcade machine behind me every like 30 seconds. And it was just very odd. And I was sitting there going, why am I doing this? Is this really what I want to do? Like I have to, you know, I have to stand here for 8 hours and take this. And this group of kids came up to the table and they had been kind of walking around the event, and they came up and they started talking about their adventures, and they've been playing Dungeons and Dragons and a couple other role playing games, and they were looking through the books and they kind of pooled their money to buy Chromeware, that the role playing game, and they went off and didn't think anything of it and kept working the convention, and then the one of the kids, it's like 13 at the time, I want to say, came back to the booth and started asking me questions. And they were asking these questions that were these little footnote details in the book, that these deep cut lore moments. And they were asking me questions about them and about the universe in these ways that I never thought anyone would get that. It was more for like, I wrote it for myself kind of thing. And the smile on this kid's face and the joy that they had, they were clutching onto the book. It was that moment that I realized, I was like, okay, this is why I'm doing it. Like this, I'm giving a story to this kid. And I actually connected with that kid and their mom and the kid came years later to a convention that I was running games at and ran a game for him and his mom actually, and have seen other kids that they've played with in their groups and they played for years. And they stopped in and play tested a couple years ago. They're like 19 now or 20 or 21. They're a lot older now, but it was just amazing that story, you know, that the game impacted that group's life at such a young age and allowed them to be creative and inventive and use their imagination. And that is what I love about storytelling. That is why I do what I do. And that is why I love writing stories and making games and creating this kind of content. And even if it's just one person that you're impacting, that's enough for me. You know, I've done my job. I worked in the entertainment industry forever. The goal is not to try to get a lot of people to see the thing you're doing. The goal is to get enough people to be moved by the thing you're doing. And that's the most rewarding thing for me in this space is seeing people at like the game I ran last night, when people realized in that group that they could steal the spell of this paparazzi individual and all of their faces just reacted and I can do that. That's so cool. And it just changed the way they thought about it. And that's rewarding. That is it. That's all you need to be rewarded for what you're doing. And that changes everything. It gives validation to what you're doing. It gives some sort of purpose.
Amazing. That's such a cool story about not only that the kid was able to come back and ask all those questions, but then that you're able to see them again so many years later.
Yeah, deep cut questions. We're not talking about just what about this group or what about this time period. That book is a textbook of just thousands of years of time organically changed over the course of this planet's life. And they came back and were pulling these little footnote one sentence lines that they digested so much of it and retained it. And they understood everything that I was trying to get across. And it was just, I mean, they're probably still the number one fan of Chrome War. I'll always give them that. And it was just amazing that they really just locked into it so much. And they played a game every week. They would write comments on our Facebook and other things. They'd be like, oh yeah, we're still playing. We play every week. It's just amazing that you can create something that others adapt to, and kind of just took that with Dark Veil and said, okay, how can we make this bigger? How can we get even more of a bigger audience that, you know, we get, make the game that much more easier to understand and learn, quicker to play, quicker to pick up. And you can literally teach this game in, you know, 15, 20 minutes at the start of a game. And by the end of a 2-hour session, everyone feels like they've played before. Our Gen Con game, none of them had played before. We had a 30 minute talking about the lore and the game mechanics beforehand. No, none of them had ever played the game prior to that. And you'll think that they've been playing it for, you know, at least a couple of weeks, if not a month. It's just that easy and fun. And that's really the wow factor for me for creating this game was, okay, we're doing something right here. If we can make a fun game that's quick to pick up, easy to learn, and is just filled with lore. I know I'm kind of doing a sales pitch, but it is. It really is all those things. And it's fun for me to run. It's really easy as a storyteller to just organically make it up. I never pre-write anything anymore. It's all just organic as I go. But yeah, it's just that's such a redeeming, wonderful thing to get that kind of reaction from people.
Oh, that's so cool. I'm so excited to dig into this game when it does come out. But Susie, this has been a really fun conversation. Thank you for coming on. And tell me, where can people find you, find the Kickstarter?
So on Kickstarter, it is the Dark Veil role-playing game. Dark Veil role-playing game, you can type in, or you can go to our website at darkveilstudio.com. The website has a whole bunch of links to the Kickstarter as well. So you can just go there, watch the trailer, either on the Kickstarter page or on our website, download the quick play. So you get the free, I think it's around 30 some odd pages of a quick play to teach you how to play the game. Download the adventure preview. So you can download a starter adventure that will take you through several hours of gameplay, if not more, and has hooks to keep playing. We've got 7 pre-made characters right now already on the website that you can play. And basically, you have everything you need to start running and playing the game. If you've never run a game before, you just need to read the quick play, and then the adventure preview will help walk you through those steps. You can also watch our YouTube videos, Darkveil Studio on YouTube, that will talk about, you'll see a video of a game actually playing through, and then you'll see a couple videos about like talking about game mechanics and such. Otherwise, at Darkveil Studio is our Twitter. You can follow us there. And I'm at T. Julian Bell on Twitter, but I will say that I'm more active on the Darkveil Studio one than I am on my own.
Perfect. I will make sure that we've got links to all of those in the show notes. But thank you so much for coming on today. This has been really fun.
No, thank you. I'm really excited to talk to a project manager for one.
Yeah, you kept just throwing out things and I was like, oh, you're speaking my language right now. You just finished another episode of Role, Play, Grow. To check out the show notes from today's episode, you can go to lightheartadventures.com/RPG. To keep up with every episode, please subscribe on your podcast player of choice. And if you're enjoying the show, I would absolutely love if you would leave me a review and share this episode with your friends. Your review might even get featured on an upcoming episode. To follow me on Twitter, you can either find me at LightheartADV for our business account, or at KetraWCR for tweets on gaming, my dog Bowser, and other random shenanigans. You can also find us as Lightheart Adventures on both Instagram and Patreon. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time on Role, Play, Grow.